Right.
Hello, everybody. It's been a minute. I'm back to doing some interviews, and today I have the pleasure of James Tunney will be joining us. He's got his most recent book, Plantation of the Automatons, which I just picked up there. And I discovered James used to be an interview he did with the Regeneration podcast, and was intrigued by his perspective generally. And he's kind enough to come on to talk. I think our sort of thematic point of departure is going to be a phrase he suggested, the net of Scientocracy. And the one thing about I noticed about your work, even though I've only been able to just scratch it here since I just got the book, is that you are fond of an almost sort of associative style of exposition. So even the word net, right? You're like, there's that word net, but then it connects, cascades into another series of considerations, net, thread, plant, so on, right? And then they like hang together. But I imagine you'll run along and sort of, but just maybe I should just turn it right over to you and ask, like, what do you mean by like the net of Scientocracy, or even by Scientocracy, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, thanks for the invitation, Tom. I'm looking forward to the conversation. Appreciate that. And I've listened with interest to some of your other interviews, particularly about Gunther Anders and that. I think it's useful. And I think they contribute towards the discourse. So, when we were having a little back and forth, the net of Scientocracy came as a framework. And why that was is because I've argued that the system that we're facing is, as C.S. Lewis described, as Scientocracy, to refer to that technocracy. And also, I would put in the transhumanist context. So that ultimately the whole point of the technological evolution is a system of governance, of global governance, and a system of rule. And in relation to the, you made a point about the impact of technology on people and whether there was a kind of suggestion of whether there's an absence there in relation to the person, how they receive it. And it's, again, following on from Gunther Anders and others, there's the question of the impact of the net and the penetration of the net into human consciousness. So recently, actually, in the context of looking at Orson Welles' Othello, I was thinking about a motif he had in his 1948 film. He's describing this Iago and this kind of creation of suspicion and this cultivation of a kind of jealousy, and he uses it as a deeper theme. And the motif he uses in that 48 film was of the net. It's a kind of, and when you look at it in that sense, and we look at his critiques in his filming of The Trial in 1962 of technology, you see this stream going through. It appears in the work of people that we don't necessarily associate with that critique. So Scientocracy, the system is based on this network. It's based on the net. That is the model. And that network is more of a crystalline structure. There are crystal models that kind of anticipate it. We can see this in esoteric thinking, a kind of comprehensive, inorganic, total coverage of the earth. We see this going back through the interest in communication technology. Communication technology was an area that I taught in relation to the legal context of, because I was interested in the conceptual elements of communication technology. I was interested in why Arthur C. Clarke was saying that the future would be merger of man and machine. When I heard that first in the 60s, I couldn't believe. I could believe all the other things. I couldn't believe that people would want that thing. Little did I know. Little did I. And that the attempt to answer that subconsciously and then consciously has become pressing, as it really is. There really is a demand for this idea that of merger with machines. So his interest, Arthur C. Clarke, in relation to communication technology is part of this building of the network, as the internet is with the military-industrial complex. But it's going back to the 1920s in Britain and the Empire and the translation of the British Empire in particular into a new form. So the net is essentially a trapping mechanism, as it is in the Shakespearean context. When Iago is talking about the net, he's talking about a trapping mechanism. And we've always seen it as a positive, or it's been sold as a great convenience. And of course, Mumford warned us about this great technological bribe, and we fall for it all the time. So Scientocracy is an accurate description and anticipation of the model of governance, which I believe we have moved into. I would argue that we've probably moved into it already, but people don't realize it. And if I was to pick a date, I'd say January 2020, that the hallmarks or the lineaments of this system are there in technology, in commerce, economic systems. And people are becoming aware through the World Economic Forum, et cetera, of these networks. But I mean, they don't pay as much attention to the World Trade Organization and these systems that have been growing up for a while. If you go back to 1992, the Zapatistas' revolution in Mexico was because they understood the impact of NAFTA and these international trade agreements have been devastating in relation to national sovereignty, in relation to the concentration of power and movement away from other systems. So all these forces have been combining together, and it's a multilateral perspective. And you're right about associationism, and part of that is because we've been put so much into little silos that we can't see the lateral pattern. So we've been going on in a vertical context, and the weft and the woof, if you like, is not being joined. So we have to join up across the pattern to link things that don't seem to be linked. And when we do, we can see this totalitarian pattern of a concatenation of all these different elements in a scientocracy, which is governed by a net, which represents the kind of world brain that H.G. Wells talked about and anticipated in his part of his world governance system by an elite. And actually, when you say the word, it's a good word about association. It was, as you know, from your study of philosophy, associationism was an important theory in the 18th century for people like Hume, and in particular, David Hartley, who was seen to be important in the evolution of the idea of psychology and the thinking about psychology. In Britain in particular, and he was quite influential on people like Coleridge. And people that were talking about his book were talking about the new world, and the new world there was the world inside the mind. It was the journey inwards. Some of these concepts that we take for granted, like the new world, we gloss over them without explaining what it is. It's in one sense, it's the new world that they're discovering inside the body, building up on the work of medical anatomy in the Dutch schools, etc., and physically going into the body, out the milieu that Descartes came out of and others. But then there was the going into the mind and into the new world. And that, in that, associationism was seen to be an accurate description of what went on and how people saw the world. But I see that type of associationism as a reflection of really the interdependence of a whole range of disparate factors that are not seen to be actually the force that they are. And the force that they are is this totalizing force, a totalitarian force, a force which unites politics, technique, economics, finance in a centralizing system, which will be automatic, which will allow elite governance, as they have told us about, as H.G. Wells has anticipated, as in particular J.D. Bernal, who's a kind of key thinker for me in this area. So Scientocracy, I think, is a useful term. Technocracy, of course, fits the bill in many senses, but in that genre. and the mechanism of the net, which I call, which I've referred to as the plantation, because I believe that the plantation is the key tool that has been used for hundreds of years by imperial systems, and their fascination with cultivation, of plants and animals, but breeding dogs, horses, etc., is a key way to understand it. And it's there in Francis Bacon. It's there in relation to his writings on plantation and in the New World, the other New World. And we can see, if we begin to reflect on the persistence of some of these ideas about plantation, we can begin to see the what's going on, and we have moved from plantation to implantation. So this is the coming into the body. So it's not just in Gunther Anders, you get a sense of the network, and you get a sense of the passivity of the individual, but we may lose sight of the penetrative quality of this system, the way it is physically coming into us, and the way it regards us as a plant, as has happened in relation to this, you know, stay at home and lockdowns and all that. It's turning the clock back. It's a de-evolution process whereby we become plants, and this mechanism by which we communicate is referred to as plants, telecommunications, etc. So that's a kind of a broad brush opening.
So there, as you're talking, like several points of inquiry occur to me. Try and run through them. Yeah. The one was, you talked at the outset about how for you communication theory was sort of the vestibule through which you entered this milieu, and this notion of emergent communication theories in the 20s and 30s being a indication for, you say, was it Clark, that this would lead toward the merging of man and machine, or the cyber, the fascination with the cybernetic and the cyborg, right? Yeah. And what's interesting to me about you making that point is communication theory often is also associated with information. But when you look at what information is really a category that emphasizes not content, but form. So like Claude Shannon in his mathematical theory of communication saw it as simply an engineering problem, right? How do you replicate a presence, a message at one point, so that it is received at another point in a fashion which permits its construal. And there's a rejection of the significance of content. So insofar as communication theory, as it emerges in the 20s, abstracts from content, I think that it actually right there is severing us from a ground in the real, in the actual, in our embodiment, right? So insofar as it then leads down an avenue of cybernetic trajectory, I think it's going to only invite us to become more and more distant from that embodiment. I don't know if you want to say something about that.
Yeah, just to respond to that. If you look at, say, for example, if I go back to my father's uncle's time when they're fighting against the British Empire in a kind of armed rebellion and that. So at that stage in the 20s, the empire shifted, it transmuted. They began to understand that they couldn't maintain the empire in the old form when they were facing a whole range of guerrilla warfare. So they began to transmute in the 20s and understood that technology was going a particular way. So if we look at the growth of cybernetics, take it in Britain, for example, with the Ratio Club just after the Second World War, or the Macy Conference in the United States, and they were part of this transmutation, and this transmutation into a global governance system. So all the theories really about information, et cetera, and communications are, and the reason why they're as you said they are, which is correct, is because they were always conceived as part of a control system. That was the whole objective. It was always control system. The cybernetics movement was part of the industrial military complex. The growth, if you look at Alan Turing, for example, and his work during the Second World War and how that was used as a crucible to develop systems and ideas and to spread through the Anglo-American sphere and through later on the Five Eyes around the world, that really it was, as Winston Churchill said in 1943 in his speech at Harvard, this is the future will be the empire of the mind. So they were well aware that they were moving into this empire of the mind. So we would have a transmutation of this imperial system onto a global scale. True organizations like NATO, for example, if you look at the books that preceded NATO, they're talking about the need for governance for the machine. The machine needed governance on a global scale. It's quite remarkable. So the point was that all these things never came out of the ether. They came out of a desire to extrapolate from science, going back to William Whewell and his work with Babbage, the Philosophical Breakfast Club, the definition of the scientist in 1833, the growth of systems of associated that Babbage anticipated in order to run an empire. These were why the systems were developed, and that continuation, mixing up with the theory of evolution and Thomas Henry Huxley and the move to dispirit discourse about human society, and have a new kind of imperial scientistic system. It was an ongoing thing that manifests itself in the 20s. In particular, well, H.G. Wells was before that. He was the torch bearer who had studied with Huxley. He was the torch bearer into the 20s, and then it's taken up and it links into other systems. Like there's a close correspondence between Stalinism, for example, in Britain, and scientism, and they go very much together. Neglected things. So. The point would be there was never any attempt to be anything other than a control system. The totality, in my view, is a control system. The bribe is the bribe to assimilate us into the system. Oh, here you can get on Facebook and post all the information. This is the kind of a bribe. Mm-hmm. This is the trinkets that are given to the to us natives to go into this digital system. You know, you'll be able to tell what your granny had for her breakfast, you know, and as a result, you begin to. So what you're saying is consistent with my argument that when Whewell and Coleridge were debating about the nature of natural philosophy, and that led to Whewell arguing for the scientist, and it broke off from natural philosophy and starts this kind of concentrated view of science, which becomes linked with which empire. The whole system thereafter, the growth of the telecommunication system, was really part of a control mechanism. If you look in particular the telegraph system, the system of post and telegraphs as well, but the telegraph system in particular, and the deep sea cables in the 1850s, 1860s, they followed the sea routes of the British Empire. This was the preparation, the transmutation already, which Dostoevsky understood when he came to London. He understood that this great technological exhibition was something got to do with Babylon and Baal. It wasn't a normal development. He perceived that when he went to the great exhibition. But at that stage, they were planning to transmute their sea power, their economic power, the technical power, the trading links into technological forms via a communication network. So the growth of modernism, and let's say modern art, for example, or various attempts at that, often goes back to around 1863, around that period, around the time associated with the growth of the telegraph. And in the United States, you have the real growth of the military-industrial complex associated with the Civil War, when you really had powerful commercial forces growing. They're all geared towards this control system and towards this concentration in a control system, whereby.
Not to cut you off. I'm sorry. Finish your point.
So The point being that the idea that it was set up for our benefit is a kind of an illusion that we suffer from. And
right, quite. So I guess I was just going to ask you about the issue of agency here. And in this sense, that Scientocracy is what? The rule of science. There's all kinds of ocracies, yeah, right? Yeah. There's the, but what is science? Science is not an agent. Science is a word, can either refer to a body of propositions to explain or attempt to explain something, or a process. Science is a process of discernment. Excuse me.
No problem.
But it's not actually something which, it's not a person. So when you talk about the rule of science, I think there's a displacement of the human subject. The human subject is no longer involved in the rule or administration or governance, if you like, of their life. Instead, they have ceded that authority, if you like, to a system of propositions that is science. At least that's the illusion, right? Okay. Because it's actually, I think, an illusion that science is so disembodied as all that. It's an appearance, but it's not all the way an accurate appearance. Okay. So my question is, when you talk about Scientocracy and the process of, you know, sort of scientocratic emergence, it's very, you know, obvious that people at the commanding heights have a profound complicity in that trajectory. However, are they perhaps themselves in a way a victim of a sort of ideological capture where they themselves are have sort of like forfeited their humanity to serve the advancement of this horrid sort of system of control which is emerging? And here I think I'm a little bit resonant with Jacques Ellul, who talks about la technique and technology as a force of its own which overrides the human subject. So I guess that to just drive my question to a more concise form, to what extent is the emergence of Scientocracy the consequence of human decision as opposed to humans abnegating their decision to an abstract system?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I was considering this recently in relation to H.G. Wells and to what extent, when he's predicting the future quite accurately, that he jumps from there to his world governance systems. When we talk about Scientocracy, we can we add into that different constituencies still, like managerialism comes into it, and just the nature of bureaucracy comes into it. But there's a kind of specific driving force, which was articulated by J.D. Bernal in The World, the Flesh and the Devil in 1929, when he said that scientific corporations would take over the world by stealth, so that the scientific elite would govern. And that was consistent with what H.G. Wells was arguing for. So it's a very specific notion. And he goes further, and he says that, there would be changing of humans into mechanical form, into silicon, and those that didn't want to go along would live in a human zoo, and they would be experimented upon. I mean, he's still a very respected crystallographer and scientist, mm-hmm. was heavily involved in the efflorescence of DNA knowledge, etc. But so I mean that's he was a Stalinist as well, so it kind of it went together. But he's still very much respected in that context. And he said, if it's a question of the competition between the curiosity of the scientist and the humanity of the scientist, that curiosity would win. He says that quite clearly.
So that's actually a theologically informed point in my view. But anyway,
yeah. But the way I read it is that he's saying that if it's a choice between not doing something that can do damage to people and doing something because you're curious, the curiosity is going to win. So this is Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, a clear kind of Mephistophelian kind of compact that are talking about, and that's the other side of it. So
is this in a sense the tree of knowledge of good and evil?
Well, yeah, it is a deep choice about, yeah, it is in simple terms. It's about Faustus, the Faustian idea. There's the pact with whatever you want to conceive it, the devil, evil, whatever, or fate. You're putting your wishes above whatever, and you are, well, either rejecting a higher force, benign force, or believing that you are the force, whatever way one interprets that. There's no question that that's there in it. It is also informed by McGilchrist's work, and I suppose that idea about the left brain, and in some senses that this type of figure seems to be blinded towards any other right. supernatural things.
It's so a kind of they monomania. May be,
yeah, and they're incapable of seeing those things to be real, which is the foundation of a lot of their unraveling. So for some of them, it's not a conscious compact with dark forces because they don't believe in them, but some of them I think do. But yes, so a lull you mentioned and Charbonneau, they both emphasized and came to a kind of conclusion out of their looking at technique that embodiment was an incarnation was the key issue, and I think there's a lot to be said for that, and Christian Roy has explored that further, and I hope we get to talk to him. He went out and met these guys, which is quite remarkable nexus. And there's a similar interesting thing parallel to the work of Gunther Anders, in that a lot of the work is now published, and you begin to ask, well, why is that not published? And the answer is clear: the propaganda model doesn't want to encourage these critiques, especially when they're accurate. So Elul provides fantastic ability to analyze the situation from his focus on technique, but there is a sense of it out of it that it's an impersonal force, and I don't agree with that, because I see it, I argue that the origin of this over concentration on the military industrial complex is really from a historical context, and it's particularly associated with France and particularly associated with the Normans, and the Normans being an iteration of the kind of Roman Empire, and that in that we have all the different ingredients, and we can trace elements back to, say, the growth of Venice when the Mediterranean was significant, and the growth of the assembly line effectively grew in the context of Venice. And you mentioned about Galileo. Galileo would have been visiting these places as well when they're talking about him as a great downtrodden hero. They forget about his links with the military industrial complex of the time, the same as Berdyaev talked about Leonardo da Vinci and these characters that were embedded or became embedded in the military industrial complex. So it's a choice. There is a number of different elements, but certainly power is critical, technology is critical, military technology is critical, the application of engineering skill, the classic model of Daedalus in a mythic sense, that the Promethean element is there, this sense that you can, through your commitment to being bold and to using firepower, you can inherit the world. And that seems to be a kind of in the Promethean element as well. So I see deliberate policy behind it. I think we failed to see that these issues were meant to be. Why are they laying down these great sea cables between Ireland and America in the 1850s, 1860s, down around the coast, down there? They were looking to the future. And as H.G. Wells mentioned this, he says, it's a bit surprising that people haven't noticed the growth of the international postal system. Now, who thinks that there's anything bad about the postal system? You know, people think it's a benign force, but it's interesting that they realized that some of these techniques could be sold as uncontroversial. They wouldn't create problems. People would assume that they were kind of innocent, that they were benign. And that's why there wasn't a lot of opposition to things like communication technology early on. They didn't necessarily see it as a kind of insidious aspect, although it became clear over a period of time that the people that controlled the communication network would also get access to secret communications, would get a commercial and strategic leverage, etc. So to answer the question, I believe that there's a number of different forces come together, but that ultimately suggest that apart from a number of different sources, the left brain, this desire for power, that kind of Faustian nature, Promethean nature, come together in the creation of a deliberate system, which is predicated on control of people. And part of this left brain thing is it doesn't like unpredictability. There's a love of predictability that drives, you know, to find an answer. And they don't want people who are unpredictable. And this is why there's a kind of hatred of biology even now in the transhumanists. Right. They don't like biology, and they certainly don't want free right. will.
Yeah. I mean, the trans, there's a lot there. There's a lot there. And there was one point where, like, I feel like I have to push back slightly, and it's not exactly really pushing back, you know, but
no problem.
You know, on the postal office or even just on the point of technology generatum, right? So there is, if you will, like the primitivist temptation, right? You're like, oh my Lord, look at this, you know, but I just feel like we have to avoid throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It seems almost fatuous to suggest that technology, or specifically communication technology, is nefarious to core, right? You know, and I think Ivan Illich is suggesting something similarly in Tools for Conviviality, that there are two different, he used the word tool, essentially, as far as I can tell, tools really are technology there, but he's contrasting convivial technology to industrial technology, or if you like, a convivial disposition toward the technological as opposed to an industrial disposition to the technological. In other words, we can't just, it seems, dispense with these facets of our world, but we have to find a way to relate with them, which is constructive and positive. Like telephony or telephones, the fact that, you know, we're talking right now, it seems somewhat disingenuous to pretend it's completely to be rejected. How do you feel about that? Is there like some, because I mean, the challenge here is that is compounded by the circumstance that we don't have the luxury of answering that technology is merely instrumental. Like, oh, well, a tool is neither good nor bad, but thinking makes it so, right? I think, well, I actually don't think that's quite right either. I really think a nuclear bomb, even nuclear technology, is fundamentally demonic, all right? And there's no redeeming it as simply an accident of circumstance. So not being able to have recourse to evacuating moral valence from the question of a technology, how do you arrive at something which is a benign technology or a good relationship to technology?
Well, I mean, as I said, my disposition was towards the benefits of technology. And my discontent is this sting in the tail, that the inevitable movement of this particular nature of technology is towards a prison system, as conceived. It doesn't mean that technology is inevitably the case like that. Now, there's a false dichotomy between, oh, you're a Luddite, or, you know, you're a Luddite, or you accept everything. That's a false dichotomy for start, and people use that, and then they say, well, why, you know, you're communicating on the internet. You know, it's an absurd to suggest that one shouldn't use the thing because one has objections to an overall network, not the fact of communicating with some particular individual. you know, there's no relationship between that. And you hear this intelligent people saying, but if you don't agree with it, you should be out, you know, and you know, living in the jungle. This argument, it comes up again and again. You should be, and you usually hear from very intelligent people, but why aren't you running around naked in the, you know, kind of idea? And this is exactly right. What the colonial powers said. This is exactly what King Leopold said when they were preparing for the, you know, the invasions in the Congo. It's the exact same arguments about bringing progress. So the technology they brought to the Congo, for example, if you want to look at that particular example, what wasn't great. It's not about technology per se. It's about the use of technology and the method of technology and the system of technology and the lack of choices. For example, in the United States, you had the problem with Standard Oil, the Rockefellers. You had the growth of antitrust law to control big trusts, big corporate, a point which Marx didn't understand, actually, which he didn't understand about the power of trusts in his analysis. It's a, I think, a neglect. But what you had was a system to regulate corporate power, but there's no system of regulation of corporate power internationally. There's no international antitrust system. So what you get is not just a factor of technology, but a factor of economic and technical control. And then you combine it with the interaction of different deep state elements, which are heavily linked to corporations. So you get all these factors that makes any debate about the nature of the technological system that we're encountering about a range of other things. It's not about technology. And there's a whole other strain, whether it be Nikola Tesla or the various work in relation to different technologies of implosion, for example, alternative ideas. There's ingenious farming systems from around the world, different ideas of land use. There's a whole range. There's indigenous knowledge, traditional knowledge. So can't be oversimplified. And as well, in this, it was predicted by, again, other futurists that I've read, like Toffler. So Toffler says, we will have the Luddites, we'll have the pro-technology people, and then we have the techno-rebels. So this is the group that people keep forgetting about. This was the key force. So the techno-rebels are people that use technology, that understand technology, but they rebel against the orthodox application of technology. And that's a position that a lot more intelligent people are in and going to be in. So there can't be that duality in relation to the analysis, and people forget about this, which was anticipated and accurately describes what is happening. And it's from that, because the point being is that the particular nature, the particular driving force between the mega machines that we've got, that Mumford began to understand where we're wrong, we're not necessary. For example, it's not necessary that you have the transport system in Los Angeles that they have. It was driven by a range of forces. It was driven by corrupt practices. It was driven by abuse of economic power. There isn't any real choice there because of the projection of other strategic interests. So there's no inevitability about the nature of the technology we get. It's driven by factors like the military-industrial complex. It's driven by the patent system, for example. It's very, very important. So, and then in all these, like Kittler in Germany, Kittler has talked about the nature of the recording industry and the way that a lot of the recording systems came from state spying and surveillance networks in Germany. You know, there's always this connection. So, but what we fail to do is to understand that we're dealing with a system of production that is in the capitalist system that is producing this particular mechanism. But the same thing is happening in the communist system. There's a technocratic force. Some theorists say that there's always a movement between romanticism and realism, and that dictates a certain view of technology. So a lot of the dichotomies about accept the whole technology, or you know, go out and live in the jungle. You know, it's
like a distraction in a way.
Right.
That reductive or like that dichotomous approach, yeah, the false binary.
It's just not an accurate representation. Yeah. It's about the control of key technologies. Now, my argument is that all of these systems are actually going towards a certain point. We're on a particular route going to a particular point, and that is the creation of a totally automatic system which assimilates human consciousness into it. That's where it's going. That's what the inevitable. So whatever way that benefits people can get for a short period of time, because remember when the printing press came out, initially there was an explosion. You could publish anything, and then they bring in the regulation. So you have the technology, you get the explosion, and then you get the control mechanism. Same with YouTube. The same. We may not be able to talk in a year or two when they say, oh, well, these guys have been talking about things, or the algorithm says, I don't like the things these guys have been talking about. So we're in a particular space, but we have to be.
Wanted to jump in to say that, you know, I think this third term that you mentioned, the techno rebel, has a kind of significance, which, as you noted, is underplayed, right? That, you know, you cannot just reject the technology. To combat it effectively, you have to understand and engage with it in certain ways, right? And there's like examples of this. Even like there's this, I don't know enough about it to speak at any length, but there's Urbit, which is trying to sort of build a new internet where instead of having these aggregated servers, everyone's computer becomes its own independent server, which allows for a sort of decentralization, which is at odds with the tendency of how the internet is.
Yes.
You know, so there are people there who are understanding technology and reframing it in a different way. And I mean, I don't know enough about it to strictly endorse it or whatever. I just provide it as an example of techno rebellion.
That's right. There are people that are very critical of the mainstream systems and wants to adopt it. That's certainly an element of it. And I don't think we can't ignore the system, and we have to understand it. And so, again, there's going to be engagement. We can't avoid that at this stage. And it is, because what we're talking about in the end is a question of balance, because that's the best we're going to get between competing forces. Absent some great catastrophe or apocalypse, we're going to be continuing to seek that balance and to seek the possibility of it. But if you look at, for example, Geoffrey Hinton, who, you know, as he's called, the father of AI in many senses, who's getting praised because he came out and said that it's going a lot faster than he thought. And you say, well, hold on a second. You know, in the past, you would have, he's not divesting of any of his shares, he said, in the companies that are profiting from here. And I mean, he is 75. I know he had a long career ahead of him, but he seems quite smug about it, in my view, in relation to what they have done. And now he's talking about the need for governance systems. So what is happening with this AI system is that the proponents are using it as leverage to achieve this objective of governance. So there is a concern which is being transmuted, and then they tell us, oh, well, we didn't understand about this thing that we claim to be experts in, although you guys were right, but now we're going to move into the governance domain. And you say, well, okay, that doesn't augur well. The reality is that they're not concerned about any of those issues. They are driven by institutional and that curiosity force. So this force.
Well, I also think there's an element of almost like naivete in a lot of the conversation I hear around AI by people who are, you know, well versed and in the field. Not just ignorami, you know, it seems that they just, like, some of the things I hear are kind of like shocking. I was listening to this interview with I was listening to Lex Fridman, who, you know, teaches AI and robotics at MIT, so he has a certain technical conversancy. And he was talking about his relationship with these machines on which he's working, these quadrupeds or robot dogs. And he talks about how, well, you know, I mean, I'm the one who's doing the programming. I program the machine and it does this, that, and the other. And I find myself emotionally engaged with the robot because the robot is programmed to respond in certain ways. And he says, and I can't completely dismiss the magic of what's happening here, as if he really wants to believe that he has been a part of a process which has given birth to some kind of proto-consciousness in a robot dog. And I'm just kind of what was disturbing about listening to him talk about it is that he seemed almost reconciled to the adequacy of a counterfeit, right? And that's what I get in a lot of what I hear from a lot of the, and I you get some really horrifying things like developing AI interlocutors that can be used to assuage people who are profoundly depressed and things to that effect. And I mean, no one seems, I mean, not no one, but there doesn't seem to be appreciation of what a monstrous suggestion that is. It's like, okay, here's a human being who's suffering. You say, well, we'll just develop this machine and that'll help them calm down. It's like, no, what you need to do is you need to cultivate a relationship with that person. That's how you help that person. You don't seem to grasp that there is a deep inadequacy, a deep, I would say, ontological insufficiency and referring to what are essentially probability machines to do the work of human engagement. But it seems like there's like a blind spot there, a blind spot. That, like you said, there's all these other things going on, political, economic, et cetera, motivations, but compounding that, I think, is like a, it's like an immaturity, which seems to have suffused certain corridors of our culture. I don't know what you have to say about that.
Well, this is well, we could, of course, as you know, we could trace it back to puppets and dolls and Plato and true literature and art, the Sandman, and this idea of falling in love with a kind of an inanimate object. And of course, the beauty for this type of mind is that this inanimate object is subject to your own control, and it comes from that. So that unpredictability is gone. You don't have to worry about the person rejecting you. It's a product. You have control over that. And there's a kind of a deep kind of fetish in some ways about this object, about this false person, about this glee that they have from beings that are a simulacrum of reality, and associate with that again a left brain blindness to the reality of humans. And this is the deep, profound point of departure that some people seem to be having more and more difficulty to understand what a human is, you know, to understand what a human person is, to understand personhood. And this is, of course, the issue that underpins the work of William Stern, Gunther Anders' father. It's there in Hannah Arendt. It's there in the Brentano, who was a teacher of Husserl, and that it's the idea, a deep idea of personhood and what a human is. And this influence it influenced people like Pope John Paul wrote about what was influenced by that stream of thinking, for example, and focusing on that issue, the key issue, from a whole range of perspectives. It comes back to that, about the individual, about recognizing the other individual, accepting the other individual, and the idea that some kind of mimic of the person can provide an adequate substitute betrays a failure to understand what a human is. But even I heard Lex Fridman talking about the pigs that Elon Musk was talking about, and even the way he talks about the pigs kind of was a reduction of their beingness, if you like, you know. And I kind of you didn't have to be a great animal lover to understand that he has a very reduced idea of what that the animate being is. That's why I have argued one of the concepts that I've tried to suggest, and seen someone else as well have used the term as the animosphere, that the totality of human imagination, mythology, literary creations, art, theology, theosophy, describes a vast internal space that we have to prize more and more. We have to prize the unique abilities of the individual as on the basis of intuition, imagination, going back to the Blake tradition, etc. And none of these guys understand those things. They can only understand the kind of instrumentalized, targeted use of the imagination, because they're in that system. Anyone working in AI and that are in that military industrial company, there's no big companies that will be working beyond the remit of that, of the commercial control mechanism. And this is the issue. This is where I argue in the work that we're facing the end of humanity. This is what we're facing. It's not just this on an individual level, it's on a species level, because the proponents in this force believe that this directed evolution is a necessary development. And by that directed evolution, we cannot have humanity as we understand it. There will be no possibility for conviviality, because their idea of a kind of zero trust society, etc., is dependent on treating the individual as a predictable part of a system. That's what the entirety of the social credit system in China is about. Again, helped with the American ideas of a technotronic society, Brzezinski, etc. So they're all going in the same direction, an ultra-materialist control system, whereby the individual is an accidental force that can be improved by prosthesis. And the last point on this, Tom, which I think is important, there's a failure as well from people that should be critical about some of these issues to see how some of their heroes, for example, Terence McKenna, talks about prosthesis a lot. He talks in terms of transhumanism, really, and we can see this in some of the people that are held up as heroes. Robert Anton Wilson, who I like a lot, but he was quite into the poor man's daughter was killed, and he was one of the first ones to have her head cryogenically preserved. I can understand his trauma, and that was terrible. But I mean, they were part of this idea of improving the human through prosthesis. And in fact, a lot of psychedelic movement is associated with this idea of prosthesis as well. So supposed solutions to some of these issues represent a movement away from accepting the individual, as I believe, that kind of reflection of a divine consciousness, whatever source you want to attribute it, or the Tao, or whatever way you want to see the world, that's in us already. And the movement is to deny the existence of that, to deny the existence of the supernatural, and to reduce the human to a puppet, and to elevate this simulacrum to the being which is superior. So, and that's clear part of their intention.
Yeah, it seems like an incredibly impoverished notion of the human. Like Ray Kurzweil has said that he wants to create some sort of replication of his father who died when he was relatively young. Mm-hmm. There's this phobia of death. They openly talk about reaching literally for immortality. Mm-hmm. And here, you know, the question of reality broadly, I think, is actually crucial. It's a point from which one can derive, I think, either despair or hope. When you, like, for instance, you say we're looking at potentially the end of human possibility, and that is because we're being surrounded by a world that is telling us that we're so much less than what we actually are. The hope is that in reality, we are so much greater than what is being suggested, and that that greatness cannot ultimately be constrained by the net, that there inevitably will be a point where the net tears, or there's some kind of, and also I think ironically, there's an implicit concession in the narrative of transhumanism on this point. So it's not, I think, actually, that transhumanists deny these broader realities. It's that they're actively opposed to these broader realities. They actually see, when I say it, I always feel like I sound like someone who's drawing some cartoon of a transhumanist, a kind of straw man, but no, this is actually what they say, right? They see death as a problem to be solved, a disease to be cured. And from where I stand, that kind of rejection of death actually is cutting them off from the fullness of what it is to lead a human life. And so there's a deep axiomatic tension there, which ultimately translates into a spiritual framework. Like, it's a spiritual, we're facing a kind of spiritual warfare, is how I am inclined to see the world at this time. And I must confess that I don't think we're the only actors on this stage. Okay. Now, I know you have to be very careful how you put that. I say that to some people and they think I'm like passing the buck. But on the contrary, I'm trying to say, no, we have a role to play. And the fact that there are other forces at hand only accentuates the importance of our role. But of course, this is a very kind of difficult thing to bring to bear in polite society because of the dominant discourse, which is so uncomfortable with other terms of seeing the world. I don't know if you maybe want to build or say anything about that.
Were you talking about supernatural forces when you were talking about other forces?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll just tell you, it might explain a bit where I'm coming from. My family in Ireland were always involved in politics. So I was always politically aware, and they were heavily involved in politics in a deep way, and revolutionary and constitutional, whatever. So I was always interested in that. But I chose law as a career, and I taught law. I was a lecturer and senior lecturer and professor and international legal consultant and works for organizations, etc. And then I gave it up and left the entirety of it, the whole lot of it behind, and because I wanted to look after the children, I wanted to paint, I wanted to have space, and you know, see what happens. Have a kind of normal life, if you like. And I'm glad I did that. But in that context, that kind of mystical element began to become more pronounced. I would have come from a Catholic background and fallen out with that. But in Ireland, there's a very strong pre-Christian element as well, a very old religion as well. Pagan forerunner as well, which still has its traces just about, or it did when I was young. So the older indigenous element was there. But I became, the first book I wrote when I said, okay, I have to come back into society, if you like, after being happily doing my own thing and painting, was the Mystical Accord. And that started off because a line came into my head, which seemed very significant, which said there has been a certain failure of spiritual evolution. That was the line. And it was one of these lines that didn't seem to be made by me, if you know, it seemed to descend out of the ether. So I kind of reflected on that, and it started off a whole stream of, maybe you want to call it a stream of consciousness, a stream of whatever, which made me really look again at what that meant. Was there anything in that coming from this? Because it felt noetic, it felt mystical in relation to its origin. So that was the starting point. That was the whole basis of my kind of looking back at this. So that was the bright side as well. I mean, it's not a bright side that it's been a failure of spiritual evolution, but it did show direction and a key thing. And I said, could it really be that all these issues that I've been looking at was based on that issue, you know, and based on the failure of spiritual evolution? And so that evolved into to examining perennial philosophy and the commonality between all the different traditions and the suggestion that there is a pattern of spiritual evolution in all individuals, and that it's ingrained in us, the same as our teeth fall out at a certain age. It's ingrained in us, and all the systems reflect this various elements of this notion. And the dark side in that was technology. That the dark force in it was technology and the growth of a religion of technology. Now, I began to feel them not on an intellectual bit that I knew from an analytical perspective, but as a deep insight, if you like, in different regime. So I began to study again all the different traditions. And now I didn't care, because I began to understand that from the time of X Club, 1864, Thomas Henry Huxley and the other scientists, they began to deliberately dispirit discourse. That was the objective. So, and to enter into, before Trotsky and Gramsci did it, this was the policy, to enter into institutions and take spiritual consciousness out. They weren't happy with the Reformation. They weren't happy with removal of the church. They wanted to remove the idea of the spirit and what I call spirit. So I believe that this talk about consciousness refers to spiritual consciousness. So that is the necessary adjective to define what consciousness is. And the scientific community from Huxley onwards has been trying to dispirit us, literally, to take it out of discourse, to create a memory hole, to convince people. And you can see this actually mentioned, funny enough, I saw it in the trial, the version of Orson Welles, when the character, a kind of stretch of Joseph K, says, there's a big dirty game. The big dirty game is to convince us that life is meaningless and absurd. And that is the dirty game. And it's been going on through scientism, in particular
radical
from the
secularism.
1860s. Yeah. In particular from the 1860s. And that's associated well with the growth of modernism in certain forms. It's also interesting in the supernatural context, or one of the streams, it's kind of manifest in some of the Marian apparitions, this idea of a force which is manifesting about them. So
there's
I have come out of the closet, and that's because they have made a taboo of talking about your spiritual consciousness. They've done it consistently. You're a nutter if you're talking about your spirit. You must be some kind of regressive individual, not very bright. There is hope. The hope is in that imperative to spiritual evolution. And the promise of the hope is that spiritual consciousness realized is superior to all the other forces. It is the repository of imagination. It is a repository of courage. It is a repository of deep appreciation of reality with a capital R. So yes, providing this is what I believe the historic, a word bigger than historic we need here, the existential call is. The call is now you have to spiritually evolve. You have to come out of the cocoon, or you can stay in there and turn to goo. That's what Frederick Myers was talking about, the imaginal. He was using this idea of emerging from the chrysalis. Now, all his study of the human personality after death, etc., and the study of psychic forces was necessitated because they weren't allowed to talk about spiritual forces. So they had to come in with psychic forces to explain other things, because this was the only word. It was invented by a lawyer in Russell Square to help them, because they weren't allowed to talk about spiritual matters. The growth of psychology at the same time was a response to the reduction of the idea of spirit. But unfortunately, psychology and psychotherapy became co-opted by the same forces as well.
Right.
So another interesting element. So the whole hope is, and it's a very simple hope, it's kind of like that, that people understand and realize that they are spiritual consciousness and they're connected to the greatest creative force that exists. And by embodying and developing that creative force, we will be able to resist. But if we don't, we're making a choice not to. We're making a choice to stay in the goo. That's what I think people are doing that now. There's no inevitability that people will say, well, I want to do that. There is a kind of spiritual evolutionary goo, which is a possible, you know, just stay in that entertained kind of chrysalis and don't move because it's too comfortable. That's a choice that people make, and they are making it. So we are at a point, and this is manifest in a whole range of contexts, where people, in my view, have to commit to their spiritual consciousness. Now, as that happens, again, we can't be prescriptive about what form. The whole point, another point, is that the effort of this military-industrial complex will be to divide people, and particularly to drive out different, say, religious perspectives. And this is a mistake that the New Age movement sometimes makes, or some of my friends in California are having discussions, and they get sucked into making the arguments that H.G. Wells and that were proposing. You know, that if we see that what they wanted to destroy was a nation state, a family, and religion, well, if you're going on doing their work about why religion is bad, you are doing the dirty work for not you. One is doing the dirty work right for them. So one has to be aware of what the games that are going on and how we're being manipulated. And of course, an easy way, for example, in the Tao Te Ching, they said what you want to destroy, you must first expand. So, for example, we see Christianity on the decline and Islam on the rise. This won't continue, and it's a mistake in Islam to believe that this scientific community will tolerate them. And in fact, if you are pessimistic looking to the future and looking at the history and the history of the fomentation of civil war in post-colonial context, or if we anticipate a type of war of independence as a prelude to global governance or something declared as a war of independence, you could anticipate the cultivation, deliberate cultivation by nefarious forces of war between different religious groups like Islam and Christianity. So I'm arguing that all spiritual people, all religious people now have to begin to move up beyond their differences and to recognize that there's a common existential threat and to not be drawn into those at a different level, and including pagans or people with different perspectives or whatever. Unless we're talking about people that want to cultivate dark forces deliberately, that which goes with this exit or this force. And that was anticipated. If you look back at C.S. Lewis and That Hideous Strength, 1945, he sees this force of scientism manifesting itself institutionally, and he knew that this was happening, as being demonic and satanic and connected with higher forces. I don't have any doubt. So another irony is that some of the people that don't want you to have any spiritual belief have a deep belief in spiritual forces, but it's a dark, a dark force. I'm not. Those elements are there, and I think it's important to honestly look at one's own beliefs and bring them
to bear. I have to say that, you know, as I mentioned, like I encountered you through your interview at the Regeneration podcast. And I'll tell you what really excited me about the interview was almost just a tangent within it, where you were talking about the fey, right? The thin places of the world and so forth. And you quote unquote coming out of the closet there. And it was actually refreshing, right? Because you said you believe that there's an ontological reality to those domains.
Yeah.
As a sentiment with which I actually fully accord. And the trick of it is that those domains are there, in my view, but we only have a vague access to them. And that means that the mode of engagement which we choose to have with those spheres has to have a kind of humility. That's when people say something about like Ouija boards or tarot cards or something like that. It sounds almost like, why are you talking about this now, right? Okay. It's like, you have to be careful with those kinds of things. And they think I'm funny. They're like, oh, Tom, whatever. It's just a toy. It's like, no, it's not a toy. Okay. You don't know with what you're dealing with. You really don't.
Yeah.
It's like an open. And if you are just sort of la-di-da about it, you're actually inviting a kind of darkness into your life. And it's an uncontrolled darkness. But it's actually important that we start re-employing these kinds of languages, because the greatest trick the devil ever pulled is to convince the world that he didn't exist, right? Okay. We have to sort of counter the presumption that the secular ontology is the only ontology. And part of that's just talking about it. So I guess this doesn't really connect strictly to any point argumentatively within conversation.
Although I'm going to refer to those beings as the good people, because after I did that talk, my bath overflowed and they were telling me you're not meant to mention them directly. So that they were you can talk about them once you refer to them as the good people or something like that. Or they'll get up to mischief. I have no problem saying that. And now, often the ontological reality of what they are is not necessarily what people think they are, which is another issue. But there's I don't have any doubt about that. I'm convinced by that, and by plenty of other forces. And again, another reference, Orson Welles, which, you know, people don't, he didn't practice any particular religion that we know of, but he didn't like agnostics, which I love. Same with like Rudolf Steiner. He didn't think that was a great position to have. And he wasn't. And he talked about faith and the importance of faith. He kind of changed in his lifetime. But in his dark Macbeth in 1948, he put in the prayer to a holy man, which is not in Shakespeare, who comes along and says a prayer to Saint Michael over the powers of evil. It's quite remarkable. And he said people didn't really notice this, but it was quite significant. He was kind that of signaling, putting in some sign of his perception of the reality of this evil, and actually manifesting in these figures, and continuing in these figures, and of course in the Shakespearean context, in Othello, but especially in Macbeth, those principalities are operating. So people interpret his rendition of Macbeth. He did say it was a clash between two civilizations he saw, but people presumed he was talking about a clash between Christian civilization and pre-Christian civilization. I don't think he was. I think he was more talking about a future clash between the end of Christian civilization and what comes in its stead. And this was a theme he has in Othello as well, when they're moving from a kind of orderliness, as he says, of Venice to a brutal castle situation in North Africa. He's indicating that society is moving into a different phase. But he had no, in my view, he had no doubt about the reality of evil. So a few years in my parents' time, they would have accepted all the reality of these beings in different forms, or it was a lot more widespread. And we have been convinced that all these things are illusions, and that at the same time we're being presented with illusory forces as real, as you've given an example in relation to the Lex Friedman. You know, there's a great inversion there. And coming from a legal background and teaching law, where you're extremely careful about every word you say and every argument you use, and every word has to be in place correctly. When I'm saying the things I do say about the spiritual world, I'm as careful, or try to be as careful about them, meaning that I believe them that to be true. And I believe that it's important that we begin to come out of the closet realize that they have deliberately created a taboo about talking about this thing. And this is disempowering, demeaning, dispiriting. And when people realize that, then they begin to unlock the power of their spiritual consciousness, which is powerful. Once they cross that line, they begin to discover their own power. The people do not realize their own power in that. And there are certain patterns that emerge from that in relation to one's own destiny when one commits to the path, the spiritual path. There is that deeper meaning, which is what people are being deprived of in this context. And as you said, there's the Achilles heel of this great big monster that we have, this great Achilles, the Achilles heel is this great fear they have. And paradoxically, I imagine a great superstition about the things that they don't understand, because they have committed themselves to sidelining something they don't believe to be real. But they will encounter the reality of at some stage, assuming that these things are ontologically real, although it's not, you know, we're still in hard to interpret the exact nature of all the different phenomena. These people will still encounter them as well. And it's worse it's worse than the examples of contemporaries. If we go back to the Russian cosmists, and they wanted to resurrect all the people that ever lived. Now, the idea is, why one would want to do that is beyond me, what the objective is. And these people are talking about immortality in a context where they're ruling over a death culture, which wants to encourage people to euthanasia, which wants to encourage mass destruction of humans in various forms. And then the implication that they want everyone to be immortal, it's such an absurd lie.
Right, there's an incoherence.
It's crazy, you know, it's beyond comprehension. But yes, that's the spiritual, the belief. Belief is important. People underestimate that, but I mean, it's proven by science in relation to placebo effect. Belief is important. It's not a blind belief, but the power of belief. Even again, I use the word Orson Welles because I've been talking about him, thinking about him. He emphasized the power of faith in something beyond. He understood that. So, but it's powerful. It's a powerful force that achieves results and can propel and motivate people. But if you don't believe in it, it's obviously not going to work. So it's that point of activation. Now, as more people activate their own potential, then we get the possibility of a kind of symbiosis of communication on a deep level, and of communication at a higher level, a deeper recognition of the individual across boundaries. Because again, so we're not going to be able to go back to the situation where, you know, I'm happy living in Ireland and nobody is going to interfere. That's gone as well. I mean, I accept that those things are gone. So there's going to be a creation of new real networks between people. Now, they don't have to be, they're not going to be structured. They're not going to be elaborated. They're not going to be organizations that be controlled. By definition, they have to be similar to something which would be consistent with an anarchist philosophy, in the sense that to work, it will have to reflect something like the graphene, which, you know, the one atom tick connection between a few different people and a few other different people. Or I use the mystic murmuration that one bird that influences the direction of seven around them. It will do through advocacy, through persuasion, through influence, through example. And that's going to start as well, more and more, that people will begin to apply the powers of discernment to understand what they're facing with, as opposed to the figure, some of the figures that are fed to them by the media. So that's a real force. And that will also have different levels of critical mass, whereby that can be used as a informal networks to be able to address and be able to focus on points of weakness and points of opportunity. And also that by manifesting the reality of spiritual consciousness, I would hope as a spiritual advocate to convince other people that are on the wrong path, that are in the system, that it's going nowhere, that it's an existential, meaningless pursuit that's destined to deprive them of a possibility of spiritual evolution as well. So there's I think advocacy and persuasion is a very, very important thing, because there will be people in there that will change their mind, that will be convinced, that will be taken out of the technocratic mindset. And they often go together. Some of the transhuman, like Zoltán István, he, you know, I heard him in an interview, one of the stations, I did an interview, and he was not only arguing for transhumanism, but he was asked about technocracy. He said, oh yeah, I'm in favor of technocracy. And in a novel that he wrote, it anticipates a war in the future between the transhumanists and the old humans. And I think that this is this may be on the cards, because they don't intend to allow people to continue to be old humans, but the old humans have to be newly renovated in a sense, in a spiritual way. There has to be a movement now for spiritual evolution as part of this combat thing. So it is very hopeful in that sense. Sorry for going on so long there, Tommy.
No, that's, I think another sort of paradox of that kind of movement, as we can wrap it up here, it occurs to me that I think it's somewhat paradoxical that the way these sorts of murmurations will unfold will necessarily be principally embodied, like where people actually are, actually concrete places. Like one of the things that happen with the way in which the world presents itself through the internet and so forth is that we no longer really feel like the world is here. It's like, oh, the world is out there, right? But when you start connecting with people like around you, then you reclaim the realization that no, it's right here with these specific people. And that sense of place is actually at deep odds with the displacement that seems to be working in tandem with the dispiriting of the discourse, right? So it's on one level, it may sound kind of hokey, but just actually paying attention to what's right in front of you is incredibly powerful in my view.
Yeah. And I was thinking an example, as you're saying that, I was thinking about a group that were marginalized in Ireland, for example, were the travelers or the gypsies, itinerants, travelers they're referred to. And it's a bit funny when you look at it now, because in many ways, some of them have, in the last generation, their fortunes have changed for a number of reasons, not least because they would have settled down or settled down in Britain. And it's a bit ironic that the world heavyweight boxing champion Tyson Fury comes from a traveler background. He's 6 foot nine or something. So what's remarkable is a group that suffered for their marginalization are producing kind of huge men, for example, that are achieving international fame in boxing, the thing that was a negative, perceived as a negative force, but part of their strength insofar as it exists. I'm not saying there's not loads of problems in the community, but that they'd acknowledge. But if you look at successes like him, derived from their opposition to and from the displacement. That was actually where strength came from in some senses. So yes, that's right. We have to think ourselves, we have to use what we perceive initially as weakness as our strengths, and use that as the stepping stone, use the perceived obstacles as the stepping stone. So that's right. We have to rethink ourselves, and we have to rethink, we will rethink, because also it will happen that people will move away from emotionally or intellectually from people that are near to them, because some people don't want to change. They're going to stay in the goo. And if you don't want to stay in the goo, you're going to be finding new families. And I believe that to be an accurate description, that's in a biblical sense as well, I suppose, the meaning behind the Christian thing about you have to leave your family. Your family may leave you when you have different viewpoints, you know. So, but that's the implication, is that you're moving to a different level. I believe that. So there's also a great opportunity of a cosmopolitan aspect. It has to be a cosmopolitan. It has to be without regard to identities that exist there, that people understand the commonality. And so therefore, I argue that the identity we have to recognize is our spiritual identity as embodied. Of course, the incarnation is important, but our spiritual identity is our identity, the person, the human in this embodied sense. And that's what we have to focus on. That's the commonality across all conditions. And that's where concepts of human dignity come from. And they exclude other elements which leads to division. So we have to get over that. We have to really make an effort to rise up to that level and to get out of different silos that they are putting us into deliberately in order to control us. You know. So again, I think there's opportunities. We have to look at things that we perceive now as weaknesses and turn them into strengths by looking at the opportunity presented. And as you're suggesting, they're becoming a yang force. So the implication, the Taoistic sense, is a yin force, which is, and the softness of the dropping water eroding the hard stone. They have disadvantages from their power now that can be transmuted by different forces. It can be balanced by different forces. So yeah, we have to think differently, and that's the challenge. We have to all up our game. We have to get beyond the previous work. Even when we're talking about the good guys like Anders and they were talking a long time ago now. We have to update our arguments, make them more sophisticated, make them more robust, coherent, expressible, communicable, and altered in accordance with, or finessed as well, to make them into kind of mimetic or memes that can be communicated to people who don't have the opportunity or disposition to go through that long trajectory of learning that we might have been disposed to.
Right. So I suppose to conclude that might be in point whereupon, you know, the notion of the plantation can be recalled usefully. Right, because that as a concept sort of summarizes plantation and implantation is what we are facing, and we have to move to get out of the implantation and the implantation, break it down, and then that's a way of framing it, which may be rhetorically advantageous. Right, because who wants to be on a plantation?
Yeah, a global plantation. Where we're the plants and we're going to be mineralized. That's the next step. Yes. So these are the realities. These systems are not disparate systems. We have to accept, and in some ways, I accept more of the technological reality than other people. I understand what it's capable of doing now. And so there's a lot of red herrings in the debates. The idea that is artificial intelligence conscious? Doesn't matter. If artificial intelligence can manage your life, that you're in trouble. If the artificial intelligence can manage what you do every day, you're in trouble. So it doesn't matter how whether it's conscious or not. It's about what impact it can have on the control of people. They're the issues, the civil liberties issues, the control of your life. So we end up like Philip K. Dick in the character where he's arguing with his door, and the door is looking for money. He has to pay him before he goes there. You know, it's not inconceivable. I'll be putting ideas in. I'm positive within that framework, but I'm not naive, and I'm not misty-eyed, and I know that a lot of people are not interested in change in their life, and I'm not going to listen to the arguments, and I'm not going to put down the beer and the television and get involved in anything. And good luck to them. I mean, that's their choice. But a lot of people won't choose it. But this is a call to people. The kind of universe is calling them. Their own potential right. is calling them. So I'm very hopeful in that frame. Certainly for me, I don't fear it. I'm not afraid of the thing. People think that I'm motivated sometimes by a fear of it. I'm not. I've passed all that, and that should be as well the courage that one gets from committing to the reality of the spiritual world. That's where as well the power comes from. They don't have that.
Absolutely. And I think that would be a sound note to wrap it up for today.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Great talking to you, Tom, and thanks for the opportunity. Yeah.
And good luck with your work. We'll reach out to excuse me. Sorry. I will be reaching out to Christian Roy to try and get him on.
I think it'd be a good addition to your ooh for you.
And I'll send you the. Got a frog in my throat here right at the end. But I'll send you all that. And thank you again. And I'll send you the links and all that. So
great. I'll stick it on my website as well, so people can get to know your work. How long does it usually take you to turn around? Or
I'll probably have it up within the day.
Right. Okay.
You know, 24 hours, so it'll be pretty quick.
Just send me a note of it, and I'll put it on my website, and hopefully bring a few more eyes to it. And good luck with your work.
And then what was just a quick question? What was the figure you said a while ago who was really kind of a key figure for you in your development? And the name is escaping me. I think he had the work, you said The Devil in the Flesh or something like that.
J.D. Bernal.
Bernal.
So he wrote The World of Flesh and the Devil. And he's a crystallographer. He's behind the movement. The DNA thing. He was investigating the structure of water. He was investigating graphite, which is a key technology. He was actually Irish. It's quite remarkable. He was Irish, but he was the one in that book that explains the agenda. The best description of the agenda, apart from H.G. Wells, is in that little book. I think it's probably available. It's easy to get. I think it may be copies on the internet on the Marxist website.
Right.
If you Google J.D. Right. Bernal, The World of Flesh and the Devil, I think they have a copy there, for example. It's not a long read, but it does tell you 100 years ago what the policy is. He's very influential in China.
Oh, I think you just cut off there. I think I lost you there, James, but we will go ahead and close it out, but we'll follow up with Bernal, look into him as well. All right, guys, thanks for listening, and I will talk to you guys soon.